Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
You have to think, like, it's really dark in England in the middle of winter. And then you get to, like, get together with a group of people and light some torches and go out in the orchard and drink a lot of cider.
We take a look at the tradition of wassailing in the cider-producing counties of England. Maria Kennedy is here today. Daniel Orr cooks a couple recipes that would appeal to our guests. First, mulled wine, and then chicken of the woods mushrooms. That's a fun nod to Jana Wilson, our backyard chicken farmer. She tells us things she wishes she had known before she got chickens. Farmers in Colorado are trying to maintain the genetic diversity of a rare breed of sheep and a new super chemical intended to fight super weeds. Harvest Public Media has that story. Food headlines our reporters kept an eye on this week with Luann Johnson.
An Indiana state senator introduced legislation that would make bans on large agricultural livestock operations null at the county level. Republican Senator Gene Lysing from Oldenburg, Indiana, says the state should be aware of local ordinances that are keeping large livestock operations out of certain counties. Lysing's proposal has been met with some concern from environmentalists and local leaders. Those in support of local government argue the bill would take away their right to decide what happens within their counties. Others cite concerns about the impact factory farms have on human and environmental health. This week, the Indiana Senate Agriculture Committee put the bill on hold. Lysing said the proposal would need more study, including the number of counties with factory-sized livestock bans. If you grab lunch at Chipotle anytime soon, you might see this sign on the door. Sorry, no carnitas. About one-third of Chipotle locations have taken pork off their menus after a supplier violated the restaurant's standards for housing pigs. The Mexican fast food chain requires most of its meat to be, quote, responsibly raised, unquote. For pigs, that means giving the animals access to outside. Most pigs raised in the U.S. live in small gestation crates and stand on concrete floors. Representatives from Chipotle discovered the violation in a standard audit of the facility in question. The Associated Press reports that there is no timeline for bringing carnitas back to the menus. And a regular family dinner can do more than feed your body, research says. Conversation around the dinner table has been shown to increase children's vocabulary more than reading to them, and school-aged children show higher test scores when they have regular family dinners. And teenagers, who frequently ate with their families, tended to use drugs less. In addition to the brain-boosting abilities, on average, children who have regular family dinners also consume more vegetables and fruits. Research has shown that an average of 88% of families still have dinner together, although it has fallen 2% in the past 3 years. We hope you share these stories on your Facebook and Twitter. The links are ready for you to grab at eartheats.org.
We talk about so many more stories on Twitter, all the food and farm news that's fit to tweet at Earth Eats. Luann Johnson makes it happen for us every week. Thank you.
You got it.
Farmers are engaged in an epic struggle with weeds that don't die even when sprayed with herbicide. Now they're looking to a new super chemical that's about to hit the market. But if farmers overuse it, they could face weeds no chemical can kill. Harvest Public Media's Abby Wendell has the story.
Weeds have gotten so bad in some cotton fields in the South, the land is unfarmable.
They're winning the fight. They're winning the battle.
Aaron Hager is a weed expert at the University of Illinois Extension Office. He says the situation is dire.
They're evolving faster, better to survive in the environment than we're coming up with solutions, at least chemical solutions, to control them.
To effectively control weeds, farmers need to use multiple chemical and non-chemical methods. But in the mid-90s, Monsanto created the Roundup Ready system. All farmers had to do was apply one herbicide twice a year. It was cheap, effective, and widely adopted. A little over a decade after coming onto the market, 9 in 10 commodity crop fields were using it. Then farmers began noticing survivors, herbicide-resistant weeds. And Aaron Hager says they shouldn't have come as a surprise.
Resistant individuals are just naturally occurring. Rare individuals that have something different.
Resistant weeds aren't a big problem until they spread, which happens when farmers apply the same chemical over and over again, like they did with Roundup. Farmers first saw them emerge in Georgia in the 90s, and they've been marching north into corn and soybean fields ever since, making farmers hungry for a new product.
Take control of weeds like never before.
In October, the government approved Enlist Duo. Created by Dow AgroScience, one of Monsanto's top competitors, Enlist is essentially Roundup, switched into high gear.
Protect what matters without changing the way you farm. Talk to your seed or crop protection supplier today.
The product is a mix of glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup, and an herbicide called 2,4-D. Farmers who switch from Roundup to Enlist will be nearly doubling the amount of chemicals they pour on their land. That has some environmental groups worried about its impact on public health and the environment. But the Environmental Protection Agency says 2,4-D is safe for both when used according to the label. The government and the industry hope Enlist will solve the problem of resistant weeds. But Mark Bernards has heard that before.
My big concern with this product is that we've used other products in the past. And because it's good and it's easy, we overuse it, and that leads to problems.
Bernards is a weed scientist and professor at Western Illinois University. Farmers have been hopscotching from chemical to chemical as weeds develop resistance. It's been called the chemical treadmill. But now, we're at a point where farmers simply can't do that.
We're right on the very edge of the chemical treadmill, and there's nothing beyond to tread onto that we can really see clearly right now. And so the concern is, do we get thrown off the chemical treadmill?
The EPA negotiated stricter guidelines with Dow to help prevent that from happening.
We've spent over a decade developing the Enlist weed control system.
That's Damon Palmer, a marketing director for Dow AgroScience. He says the company developed training programs to educate farmers about how to responsibly use the product with resistant weeds in mind.
We really need to make sure it's a sustainable tool and can be utilized into the future. And it's really going to be diversity of weed control that'll allow that to happen.
Bernards, the weed scientist from Western Illinois, says multiple strategies are necessary, but they're also time-consuming and costly. He suspects producers will need more than just the knowledge of how to change to actually do it.
Do there need to be incentives for farmers to adopt some of these things? Or do there need to be penalties in the existing programs that we have if they don't?
The U.S. Department of Agriculture is asking the same questions, something they might act on down the road. Meanwhile, farmers will be put to the test this spring when Enlist Duo becomes available on a trial basis in 6 states across the Midwest. If they fail, they could spray themselves into a future that looks a lot like the past, one that includes chopping weeds by hand. Abby Wendell, Harvest Public Media.
Coming up in the second half today, we meet the farmers who are working to save a rare breed of sheep. When you go a-wassailing, you could be doing one of two things. There's the house-visiting wassail, which is the practice of singing carols door-to-door during the Christmas season. The other type of wassailing is the orchard-visiting variety. That's Maria Kennedy's bread and butter.
I went to my first wassail at the Lempster Morris wassail.
She worked with cider makers in England as part of her studies in folklore at Indiana University. She was one of 300 people at that wassail.
I showed up at this pub in pretty much the middle of nowhere in a little village in the north part of the county of Herefordshire. They led us all out to the orchard, carrying torches and banging drums.
And singing, lots of singing. The noisy procession into the apple orchards is meant to wake up the trees and scare away evil spirits.
Some people actually beat the tree with a stick. And they poured some cider on the roots of the tree to give it back some of the juice it had produced.
Wassails are traditionally held on either the evening of January 5th, Twelfth Night, or on January 17th, which is the date of Old Twelfth Night, before the introduction of the Gregorian calendar in 1752. Kennedy helped revive the wassailing tradition on Broom Farm in Herefordshire when she was there in 2012. In addition to the singing and noisemaking and general merriment,
we built 12 little fires around the biggest apple tree. And the 12 fires are said to represent either the 12 months of the year or the 12 apostles. Then you build a 13th fire, which is the Judas fire. And you're supposed to stamp out the Judas fire.
What kind of songs are you singing?
There are a number of traditional wassail songs. There's the Gloucestershire wassail.
It's hard to know how long people have been wassailing, but it likely originated long before Christianity came to Britain, since 600 AD. Kennedy says it was traditionally done by agricultural laborers.
And it's kind of like a contract, almost. The laborers are saying, you know, if you treat us well and give us stuff to eat, both symbolically and actually, like they're going to give you some cakes and some things to eat tonight, and hopefully for the rest of the year, you're going to pay us well and be a good employer. And we're going to, in exchange, sing to your trees and make sure they're going to bear a lot of fruit.
And then it's back to the fields the following week for what's called Plow Monday. These days, Kennedy says wassailing is a good excuse for a party right before the work starts up again.
You have to think, like, it's really dark in England in the middle of winter. It's rainy and it's cold and it's really dark all the time. And then you get to, like, get together with a group of people and light some torches and go out in the orchard and sing some songs and bang some pots and drink a lot of cider. It's a good thing.
Maria Kennedy studied folklore at Indiana University. She worked on orchards in the cider-making region of England. Whether you're in England or Indiana, cold days mean hot drinks. Here's a mulled wine for us to enjoy, or you can do this with cider instead if you'd like. This recipe is intended for your less-than-favorite bottles of wine. Perhaps they've been sitting on the shelves for a while. See what Daniel Orr comes up with.
So you'd add all these spices and you'd sweeten them up a bit. And basically it's the same ingredients for the mulled wine and a hot apple cider. So what we have here is I've got about 3 bottles of red wine here. All right, we're going to add about 2 cups of brown sugar. And we're going to add some honey. Okay, and now we're just going to add our spices. What we're going to do to make this easier to serve so you don't have a bunch of UFOs flying around is that we're going to take cheesecloth and make a sachet out of it. So we've got some au poivre blend, which is a blend of 5 peppercorns. We've got some cloves. I've got some bay leaves, a little bit of coriander seeds, some fennel seeds, some cinnamon sticks, which I just like to break up just a little bit. And we're going to put some thyme. Now, this is some thyme that I got out of my garden right before the first big heavy freeze came. Put that in the refrigerator in a Ziploc bag with a little bit of wet paper towel, and it's kept for about a month and a half. And now we're just going to tie this up. Now, I'm using a crock pot for this, but you could do this right on the stove. I'm going to float some nice oranges on top of this, and we're just going to let that mull for 45 minutes to an hour. So that's our hot drink of the day.
The recipe is at eartheats.org. Daniel has a mushroom dish for us in the second half of the show. Then Jana Wilson gives advice to wannabe backyard chicken farmers. Number 1, lock your chickens up at night and when you're out of town.
Golly, you'd think people would know that, but I have talked to many people who have left their chickens out, then went away for the weekend. They said, well, I just thought we'd leave the chickens out so they could go in and out of the coop. And don't do that.
And 4 other things you should know before you get backyard chickens. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick, Cadillac Boulevard, and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington.
Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Today we're going to be cooking some chicken mushrooms. The reason they call this chicken mushroom is that it really does have the taste and texture of chicken. So we're just going to take these over to the stove, and I'll do a quick saute with them.
A very healthy serving of butter in there in a hot pan.
Yeah, I would say that's about a half a cup of butter, but we have about 2 pounds of mushrooms, and these mushrooms can tend to be a touch on the dry side. You'll see that I'm going to add a little liquid, kind of like it's going to be between a saute and a braise. And what that will do is it will encourage the butter to be absorbed by the mushrooms, and it'll make the mushrooms a little more tender. All right, these are starting to get nice and hot. I'm going to add my garlic scapes. So to about 4 cups of mushrooms, about a cup of garlic scapes chopped up. I'm going to add a little bit of braising liquid, otherwise known as water. Okay, probably put about a half a cup of water in there. I'm going to give these a taste. I'm going to let a little more of the liquid evaporate out of them. And then I'm just going to put a little more butter. And that's going to make them much more luxurious and give a great mouthfeel to them. Now, again, these mushrooms, they might feed 10 people, you know, so if we use these as a garnish on a salad. So, you know, there is quite a bit of butter, but we're not going to eat a whole bunch of them. All right. I just took some of that nice buttery mushroom and scape juice and spooned that around the outside of the mound of mushrooms and just keeping it simple. Bon appetit.
In the kitchen with us, Chef Daniel Orr. See this recipe at eartheats.org. Researchers are collecting and preserving genes from all kinds of plants and animals. They want to guard against pandemic disease or natural disaster. That's why ranchers in Colorado are trying to save the black Welsh mountain sheep. For Harvest Public Media, Laura Palmisano went out to visit the rare flock.
Come on, boss!
It's a sunny morning at Desert Weir, a 40-acre sheep farm outside of Paonia, Colorado. Uji McGuire and her husband own this farm. They raise black Welsh mountain sheep. They're smaller than the white sheep most people are used to seeing. They're solid black, and the males have curled horns.
There are less than 10,000 worldwide. There's about 1,500 in North America. We have a small population up in Canada and a slightly larger population down here in the U.S.
Farmers in the United Kingdom and Belgium also raise this rare breed. McGuire's flock is about 200 strong.
They are the only all-black breed of sheep in the world. They are dual-purpose, bred to be both meat and wool.
McGuire has been raising black Welsh mountain sheep for 17 years, and she's passionate about them.
Oh, you're the little brat that needs a shot.
Her sheep are also a research flock for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. For the past decade, two researchers from the USDA have been coming to this farm to collect genetic material from this flock. On this day, they came to gather ram semen. They work for the National Animal Germplasm Program based in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Germplasm, reproductive material, and that may be semen samples, frozen embryos, tissue samples, blood.
That's Scott Spiller. He's one of the program's scientists.
Our group started in 1999. We were mandated by Congress to start to back up the nation's animal, food, and fiber genetic resources.
The researchers freeze the genetic material they collect from sheep and other livestock and store it in a gene repository. Dr. Phil Purdy is an animal physiologist with the Germplasm Program. He says the McGuires took a tour of the repository during a livestock conference and quickly volunteered their flock.
They were very progressive in terms of breeding. They said, hey, we need to be able to accomplish a couple things. We want to be able to back up the Black Welsh Mountain sheep genetics in the repository so that if it ever is needed in the future in the United States, it's available.
Purdy says not only does the program act as a gene bank in the event of a disaster, like a disease outbreak, but the genetic material is public domain. Producers and researchers can request samples for study or to increase the genetic diversity of their own animals. Black Mountain Welsh sheep were imported from the UK in the early 70s. McGuire says the founding population for the breed in the U.S. was only 11 animals. So she's working with fellow producers across the country to try and preserve the genetic diversity of the sheep's North American population.
We've become the central place, so we're trying to get rams in of all these bloodlines to make sure that we've got them here so that they can store them in the gene bank.
McGuire sends and receives sheep from across the U.S. It's one way to ensure that her flock and others are getting new blood.
The genetic diversity that these sheep represent is something that you cannot regain. Once you lose genetic diversity, it's gone forever.
For Harvest Public Media, I'm Laura Palmisano.
That story came to us from KVNF in Paonia, Colorado. More stories of food, fuel, and field at harvestpublicmedia.org. Jana Wilson is our backyard chicken guru.
Well, I've been called worse.
We love having her in the Earth Eats studios to talk about her adventures raising birds and showing them at poultry competitions. For years, she's raised primarily Sicilian buttercup chickens, a breed that's listed as threatened by the Livestock Conservancy. She expanded her operation this year, and she's now also raising Anconas, which are on the watch list. They're blackbirds covered in white polka dots.
They're kind of like reverse Dalmatians. They're very beautiful birds.
She got them mainly because they're good egg layers. As she's become more experienced with chickens, she's also become more practical.
When I first started out with chickens, I think I was like a lot of people. I'd look in the catalogs. It was like looking at a flower catalog. Ooh, they're pretty. But what I have learned since is that chickens, different types of chickens, have different personalities. They were bred for different things. And I tend to gravitate toward those kind of lightweight, active and flighty, and they, you know, are always curious kind of birds.
So you're here today to tell us five things that you wish you'd known before you got chickens. So let's just get started. It's January. Is it too early to be thinking about getting chicks for the very first time?
Absolutely not. No. In fact, January is a perfect time to start thinking about getting chicks because this is the time of year you do some planning. If you're going to order chicks from a hatchery, quite often you have to place your order now. Now's the time to do research. You can research and find out about what kind of housing they need, what kind of food they need.
And the regulations that your city has if you're in the city limits.
Absolutely. Yeah. And every city has different laws, and you need to know what the laws are in your particular city.
So you got these Anconi, you said, because of their egg-laying capacity. One of the many reasons you got them.
Mm-hmm.
Chickens have a lifespan of between 5 and 7 years. They're not going to be laying eggs for that whole time.
No, they're not. So chickens, it's a long-term commitment for sure. You know, their peak egg-laying years are like between 1 and 3 years old, but they don't just stop after 3 years. I've had hens lay up past 8 years old.
Oh, wow.
Now, what happens is after 2 or 3 years, they don't lay as often. When they're in their peak laying years, they'll lay an egg like once every 25 hours. As they get older, it may be just a couple of eggs a week.
Now look, if you're buying chickens, you order females, but that doesn't mean that you're not going to accidentally get a male chicken.
No, it does not. That's exactly what that means. How this works is the hatcheries hatch thousands and thousands of chicks, you know, on a regular basis. They have people who work at these hatcheries called chicken sexers, and their job is to sit and look at little day-old chicks and determine if they are male or female.
Oh, my.
They're going to miss a few here and there. And it happens more often than you'd think. And, of course, if you live in the city, you can't have a male.
Yeah, so that's a problem. What do you do?
Well, there's a number of things. It kind of depends on you and your personal feelings about things, but I know the first thing most people do is they'll go on their Facebook group, or they'll go to Craigslist, or just get the word out that you have a male, and it might be a breed that somebody really wants. You just never know. So that's always an option. If that doesn't work, and unfortunately it does not work a lot, you may have to look for other options. So, you know, you get attached to them, but you have to be realistic and you have to think ahead about what will happen.
At what age will you start noticing that
uh-oh, this is a rooster.
It really depends on the breed. It can be anywhere from, let's say, 4 weeks up to 5 or 6 months. But generally by then, most people know.
They've heard it.
Yeah.
You mentioned that another one of your rules for things to know before you get chickens is learn about their health. Learn what you need to do to keep them healthy.
I've had chickens for 12 or 13 years. And the hard truth is that there are very few vets that know very much about poultry. So what happens is you have to become your own vet. There's a lot of good information out on the internet. There's a lot of bad information. I generally tend to look at websites that have a .edu, a university, agriculture university, generally tend to have the most reliable kind of information. There's also a really good book called The Chicken Health Handbook by a woman named Gail Damerow. I really recommend that for beginners as well, just once again to understand what could happen.
Keeping your birds healthy, you also have to keep them safe.
Yes.
Something people need to know is that chickens need to be shut up at night, mm-hmm. or they will be killed by predators.
Golly, you'd think people would know that, but I have talked to many people who have left their chickens out, then went away for the weekend. They said, well, I just thought we'd leave the chickens out so they could go in and out of the coop. And don't do that. Chickens are the snack food of the animal kingdom.
You've
pretty
said
much.
That before.
I know. Everybody loves chickens. And if you leave your doors open, if you don't put them away at night, they are going to get killed. It's just the way it is. So before you get your chickens, go online and read about how to make coops that are safe, that you can lock up at night. And when you're making your coop or buying your coop, make sure it's healthy for the chickens, too. Healthy meaning it doesn't have leaks, you don't have water inside of it, it has ventilation, all very important.
Jana Wilson comes in to talk to us about raising chickens in your backyard. She has Sicilian Buttercups and Anconas.
Yes, very good.
Your brand new breed. Thanks for being here. Yeah. It's been fun.
Yeah, it's been really a lot of fun. Thanks.
Jana has posted even more tips for beginning backyard chicken farmers at eartheats.org. Just a quick search away from the homepage. The coop at Earth Eats includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, Casey Zakin, and the team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33-RELAX. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. A great week to you, hopefully full of great food. I'm Annie Corrigan.